From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Trump administration said today that it plans to roll back environmental rules that were supposed to limit methane gas emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency's Ann Idsel described the decision this way on a conference call with reporters.
It seeks to stop that burdensome and costly federal regulations which impact the oil and natural gas industry, and that also, as a result, add some pretty considerable extra cost to domestic energy production while providing just minimal environmental benefit.
Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. Environmental groups are outraged with today's announcement, and even some of the world's largest fossil fuel companies are pushing back. NPR National Desk correspondent Jeff Brady joins us now. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
The Obama administration put these rules into place in 2016. What are we learning today about what exactly the EPA wants to roll back?
Right. Those 2016 rules, they required oil and gas companies to install equipment and technologies to limit methane leaks from oil and gas wells and some of the equipment that's used to process and transport it. Those rules, they were essentially being revoked under this proposal. They were designed to reduce methane leaking out into the atmosphere. And that's important because, as you said, it's a greenhouse gas. And this proposal essentially revokes those Obama-era requirements. The EPA says methane would be indirectly regulated by other requirements, but environmental groups argue that's not enough.
And can you just remind us how powerful of a greenhouse gas is methane?
Yeah, it's very potent. Methane makes up only about 10% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, according to the EPA. Most of that the greenhouse gases are carbon dioxide. That's what we usually hear. But methane is about 25 times more effective at trapping the Earth's heat. So to address climate change, scientists say it's really important to limit methane emissions. Yeah, and so there are other sources of methane, livestock and landfills, but the oil and gas industry, that's the largest source. So you really got to address that if you're concerned about climate change.
Well, I mentioned that big oil and gas companies, these are giants like Exxon and BP, they're actually not eager to loosen these rules. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, that's some of the names you'd recognize. ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, those are among them. These are also big natural gas companies, and they see gas as a transition fuel to a lower carbon economy because natural gas emits less carbon dioxide when it's burned than other fossil fuels do. But they're also concerned that natural gas could get a bad reputation if methane leaks are not addressed. And they've actually pushed for more regulation. Ben Ratner with the Environmental Defense Fund, he's been working with some of these oil and gas companies. He says the industry is very fragmented. Not everyone agrees. Not all the oil industry groups or companies support this. And that's why an overall national rule is needed.
It's absolutely essential to have a regulatory floor to bring all of industry along in these proven, cost-effective, best management practices, like checking for leaks at a well pad a couple of times a year and fixing them to save that lost natural gas and reduce the climate harms.
And, you know, we heard from the president of Shell in the U.S., Gretchen Watkins, and she says no matter what the administration does, she's got a plan with her company for reducing methane emissions, and she's going to continue with that plan.
Now, the Trump administration has a history of slashing regulations. Of course, we've covered it many, many times on this program, even when many of the affected industries aren't really calling for it. Just look at what happened with car companies that were opposed to the president's attempts to relax emission standards. Why does this keep happening?
You know, it really goes back to President Trump's America First pledge when he was sworn into office. And this country has become a huge oil and natural gas producer in recent years, thanks in large part to hydraulic fracturing. Much of that is happening in red parts of the country where President Trump is popular. And he talked about the country's oil industry earlier this week after the G7 meetings in France when a reporter asked him about climate change.
I want clean air. I want clean water. I want a wealthy country. I want a spectacular country with jobs, with pensions, with so many things. And that's what we're getting.
And President Trump also said he doesn't want to lose that wealth to what he calls dreams and windmills. The president, of course, has called climate change a hoax in the past.
So what's next? The EPA tried to do something similar in 2017 with these rules, but the courts stopped it.
Right. Well, the EPA is going to go out, and this is a proposal right now, a proposed rule. So they're going to go out and get some comments, and then they're going to hold a public hearing in Texas. But I think if you look out a little farther than that, we can all expect a few court challenges here. This thing is going to be tied up for a little while, maybe even past the 2020 election.
All right. We'll keep an eye on this. That's NPR's Jeff Brady. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, in the wake of the mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, earlier this month, in which a lone gunman killed 9 people and wounded 27 others in 32 seconds with an AR-15-style assault weapon, some Ohioans are pushing to tighten regulations for person-to-person gun sales. That includes sales that happen online and through social media. Authorities say the weapon used in Dayton was purchased online. But some gun dealers say new regulations would violate their rights. From member station WOSU, Paige Flager reports.
How's it going?
William Wood answers the door to his suburban home in Columbus, Ohio, with a Glock 19 on his hip. His two toddlers, Daisy and Wesley, peek out from behind his legs.
I can't have one.
Cartoons are playing on the TV as Wood shows me his gun collection in the living room. He pulls loaded gun magazines off a closet shelf, buried underneath Monopoly and Candyland.
The camo one here shoots a 300 blackout. This is a standard 5.56 round that that's the kid in Dayton. He used that, unfortunately.
Wood lays his guns down on the kitchen table and pulls up a chair in front of a window fan. I contacted him through Facebook Marketplace, where he was selling a Ruger gun. Wood has been selling guns on Facebook and other platforms for 10 years.
They don't allow gun sales on anymore on Facebook, so we've had to get a little creative when it comes to, you know, trying to advertise something like that.
By creative, he means posting pictures of gun cases instead of the actual firearms. Facebook Marketplace is littered with posts like that.
We've had to make fake names and fake profiles and other stuff like that to keep ahead of this. And I feel that we shouldn't have to. I mean, it's the same thing as selling a bicycle or a car or a used car. A used car could be more dangerous than a gun can be.
What Wood is doing is perfectly legal, but Facebook's terms of service prohibit posts that offer to sell, gift, or transfer guns, gun parts, or ammunition. In a statement, a Facebook spokesperson says, quote, "If we catch someone selling guns, we take immediate action." Under Ohio law, these person-to-person gun sales are allowed, though they are largely unregulated. Wood says he usually checks a person's driver's license and then goes with his gut.
Of course, I wouldn't sell to, like, what they, you know, the thuggish types. And, you know, you could tell this guy's got face tattoos and he's probably been to prison a couple of times. I wouldn't consciously sell somebody like that.
That judgment call, with no other follow-up, is legal in Ohio, which, like most states, does not require a background check for private gun sales. The group Ohioans for Gun Safety wants to change that.
Right now, if you purchase a gun at a sporting goods store, you go through a background check with a licensed firearms dealer. But if you have a private sale between two individuals, then there is not a background check. We're closing that loophole.
Dennis Willard is a spokesman with the group.
A Quinnipiac poll found that 90% of Ohioans, including 87% of gun owners, support background checks for gun safety.
But Columbus lawyer Derek DeBras, who advertises as the gun lawyer, says there are logistical issues with background checks for private sales.
So if I saved up my money for a year to buy a very cheap pistol for self-defense because somebody's threatening my life, and the person selling it to me has to run a background check, who's going to pay for the background check, right? It's a constitutional right that I want to invoke. Is the government going to pay for that?
DeBras points out that background checks are required in some private sales, like those that happen across state lines. That's what happened in the case of the Dayton shooter. But he says in-state person-to-person sales have fewer legal guidelines.
The issue is, are you doing it for business purposes? That violates federal law. And it violates Ohio law if I'm doing it where the person buying it, it meets certain criteria. They're a violent felon, a drug-related felon, they're underage, whatever it might be.
Go lay down.
Back in his kitchen, William Wood says he's vehemently opposed to background checks for private sales.
This particular issue, it would kill the entire used gun industry. It would not at all help the gun violence issue we have. It would limit the sales and acquisition for regular people like myself.
Wood argues that more obstacles from the government or from sites like Facebook would impede his constitutional right to bear arms. Gun control advocates like Ohioans for Gun Safety say those obstacles are worth it. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager in Columbus.
Well, a quick check now on Hurricane Dorian, which forecasters say could be a Category 4 storm when it reaches Florida Sunday night or Monday morning. Speaking to reporters this morning in Miami, Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis said it's still unclear where the hurricane will hit when it arrives.
You could make a case for places like Miami and the Keys to get impacted. You can make a case for it to be northern Florida, obviously central Florida. So really the key is to have your plan and make those preparations right now.
DeSantis said he's asking the Federal Emergency Management Agency for a pre-landfall declaration that would help the state get federal aid with less delay. The next Democratic presidential debate is 2 weeks from today, and unlike the last two, it'll all happen on one night with 10 candidates on stage. They'll be former Vice President Joe Biden, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro, California Senator Kamala Harris, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and entrepreneur Andrew Yang. The debate will take place in Houston and will be hosted by ABC News and Univision. The last debates were split over two nights with 20 candidates total. Stricter qualification rules from the Democratic National Committee are the reason there will be only 10 candidates this time. Those candidates had to reach at least 2% in four state or national polls recognized by the DNC and get 130,000 unique donors from at least 20 states. The next debate in October has the same qualifications, meaning that the same 10 candidates have already qualified, but more may as well. Well, most American homes are heated with fossil fuels, mainly with natural gas. But in an effort to increase efficiency and reduce carbon footprints, some are making the shift to electric heat pumps. Here to explain is Vijay Modi, who is a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, what are heat pumps and how do they work?
So heat pumps are very similar to air conditioners. You come home on a hot day, you turn it on, it cools down your room. But even after the room is cool, the outside heat wants to keep coming in. And what an air conditioner does is, using electricity and a compressor, keeps your room cool by taking heat from inside the room and dumping it outside. Mm-hmm. And that way, it maintains a steady, cold temperature inside. A heat pump can do both, keep you cool in the summer and keep you warm in the winter.
Using a compressor.
So in the winter, it uses electricity to drive a compressor again. But now, it takes heat from the outside and quote-unquote, pump it into your inside space. And in doing that, it is far more efficient on most days than baseboard heating.
Why? Why is it more efficient?
Because it utilizes the outside heat from the cold air to put it in rather than create heat the way a toaster does. It literally converts that electricity into heat. That's what baseboard heating is. And that's why baseboard is not efficient, whereas a heat pump actually moves heat from the outside to the inside.
What is the difference in cost in having a heat pump versus having a traditional, gas furnace or heating your home in another way?
There are two issues of cost. One is the first cost. And then there's the recurrent cost. Let's talk about the first cost. Most homes in the U.S. have a central forced air heating system. Many already have a central air conditioning tied into that four-stair system. Mm-hmm. If you have that, then the next time you replace your AC, you just replace it with a heat pump, and it would only cost you a couple of $1,000 more. If you don't have an existing central air, it may cost you $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, depending on the size of the home. But the good thing is it will do both cooling and heating for you.
Okay, and then what about the cost of actually operating a heat pump versus a traditional heater?
So in terms of operating cost, let's take a typical cold day in the Northeast. Let's say it's 30 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit. If you used heating oil, it will take you, let's say, 2 gallons a day to heat your home. At $3 a gallon, that's about $6. If you had one of these heat pumps I'm talking about, you'll use about 20 units of electricity to do the same job, and that will cost you $3 that day, about half of what you paid for oil. So first of all, if you are using fuel oil or propane, on most days, you would cut your fuel bill, so to speak, by half.
Hmm.
But more than that, that fuel oil would have put out about 50 pounds of carbon dioxide in the air. Whereas, if I'm in New York, our grid is clean and it's going to get cleaner. But even with the current grid, I would put out only half the emissions into the air of CO2. So it's kind of a win-win. It's both cheaper to operate and it puts out half the emissions today. Of course, we in New York have just passed a very aggressive law, Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, that will drive down those heat pump emissions even lower. Whereas if you continue to use, you know, some of the fossil fuels, those emissions won't change.
So that brings us to another part of the story, which is that in order for a heat pump to be most efficient, if you're getting your heat through electricity, the electrical grid has to be powered by more renewable fuels, doesn't it?
That is very correct. We here in New York, already with the use of hydropower and nuclear, on most days you'd already come out ahead even now. But I completely agree with you. This technology really pays off as you keep cleaning the grid. It has to work in sync with our cleaning the grid.
Now, the heat pumps, as I understand it, are getting much better technologically to the point where it used to be that if you lived in a northern climate, you probably wouldn't have a heat pump. But now they're a little bit better for people even in the north.
That is very correct. In fact, they do drop in efficiency on a very cold day. But the newer models, they are sometimes called the cold climate heat pumps, are not so bad. And even on those cold days, they would do pretty well.
So do you think that we are seeing a trend right now that is going to get this country much more into heat pumps than it is right now? Because at the moment, about 48% of homes in the U.S. are heated with natural gas and 37% with electricity.
The dominant number of homes in the U.S. are still heated by gas, propane or oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they are heated by electricity, they are frequently baseboard.
Right.
So, yes, we do need a transition, and we have to make that transition very cost effective. One way to think about it is on a very cold day, which only happens, let's say, 10 or 15 times in a year, you may need a much bigger heat pump. And, you know, then it starts to be not good on the customer's pocketbook. But if you already have a gas or propane or oil-fired four-stair system, you could actually add a heat pump to that system so that now you have what is called a dual-source system, so that on most days you'd use electric, except for those very cold days, you'd continue to use gas.
So it's like a hybrid car, basically.
this is exactly like the hybrid car model. And what's interesting is that if you took this hybrid approach, on those very cold days, yes, you'd use gas, but the total amount of gas you would use would actually come down by 90%. And other thing is, on those very cold days, if everyone started to use a heat pump, it could stress the electric grid. And this approach allows us to not have to make huge investments in the electric grid right away and continue to use both electric and gas and yet reduce our emissions dramatically.
Well, so let's finally talk about that. How big of a difference would it make in terms of the carbon footprint of the United States if people really made the switch over to heat pumps?
So I think it is, first of all, very significant, but especially the areas that I have studied in the Northeast, we would have a very big impact. And the reason is that currently the building sector is one of the largest emitting sources of emissions. And in the building sector, the dominant emissions are from heating, not from using your TV or lighting. And so if we could take such approaches where we both clean the grid and deploy these efficient heat pumps, then the emissions from heating could be reduced by as much as 90% by using this new approach.
That is Vijay Modi, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The decision by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to suspend Parliament, which was approved by the Queen, sparked a furious backlash from opponents of a no-deal Brexit.
Stop Brexit! Stop the coup! Stop
Brexit! Demonstrators chanting Stop Brexit! Stop the coup in Scotland as protests erupted across the United Kingdom yesterday. But Conservative Party MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, a hardline Brexiteer, dismissed that backlash.
I think the outrage is phony, and it is created by people who don't want us to leave the European Union and are trying very hard to overturn the referendum result and don't want the benefits of leaving the European Union.
Joining us now is the BBC's Naomi Grimley. Naomi, despite what he said there, there is real anger about this. It's clear.
Oh, there certainly is. There's anger amongst many MPs and peers, even those on the Conservative side. There's a significant faction there who feel that they haven't been treated fairly by the government because they've been deprived of this extra time to discuss Brexit. Also, quite a lot of criticism in the British press. Let me just read you out a line from the FT editorial on Thursday morning. It says, "History has shown that charlatans, demagogues and would-be dictators have little time for representative government." It then goes on to say that Boris Johnson has been grossly irresponsible, and it's even suggesting that Britain should now be run by a caretaker government of Jeremy Corbyn, who's a sort of Bernie Sanders-style socialist. So that's a sign of how topsy-turvy things are at the moment.
Now, there are people who don't want a Brexit at all, and then there are also people who don't want Britain to leave the EU with no deal. What are those people going to do now other than just get out in the streets and protest?
Yes, so that's part of the problem within Parliament, that there's a spectrum of opinion on the Remainer side, as it's often referred to, because, as you rightly point out, not everyone wants to see a no-deal Brexit, but also some people would prefer to see a managed Brexit. They don't have a problem with that, but they don't want a no-deal. And that has been part of the problem, that they haven't got their act together because of their divergent opinions. Really, inside Parliament, there are two options. Next week, they could try and force Boris Johnson from office by calling a vote of no confidence. The other route is that they try and grab hold of the legislative agenda and legislate for a delay to Brexit that would perhaps take 6 months. That would then put Boris Johnson in a very difficult position, because would he actually ignore the will of Parliament?
Boris Johnson has said that he wants to get a better deal for Brexit from Europe. Have we heard from the EU in the last 24 hours?
Well, Michel Barnier has tweeted in the last few hours, and he's suggesting that the EU is going to hold firm to its position. He talks about how they will not compromise peace in Northern Ireland. So that does suggest there's no last-minute concessions that will be had over the next few weeks from the European side. However, as you hinted at, many people think Boris Johnson might be playing a kind of bluff game, if you like, where he's pushing Britain to the brink and hoping that the EU compromises because it doesn't want to see Britain crash out of the EU with all the economic aftershocks that would send, not just in Britain, but across the continent.
That is the BBC's Naomi Grimley in London. Naomi, thank you.
Thank you.
Cities are under attack. Big cities like Baltimore and Atlanta, and small cities across Texas, California, and Florida, they're falling victim to hackers who infiltrate computer networks, lock up data and key systems like email and phone lines, and then demand a ransom to get them back. By some estimates, city leaders in more than 60 cities have had to ask themselves an important question: should we pay the ransom? We're going to hear now from two of those cities, each with a different answer. Joe Helfenberger is city manager at Lake City, Florida. They were attacked back in June. Joe, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And what happened when the hackers infiltrated your system? Did it just grind everything to a halt?
Immediately it did. We came here on June 10th, and there were no use of the phones or the computer or anything that you normally communicate on. We had phone service restored about a day later, and this was the system, the non-public safety system. The public safety system never missed a beat.
So the cops weren't writing tickets by hand?
No, they were not. But everything else came to a screeching halt for a while.
For how long?
The phone was down for one day. The use of the computers was about a couple weeks. We got about 90-95% unencrypted. We're still working on it.
Okay, so the attackers demanded 42 bitcoins to release this data, which works out to about $460,000. Why did you decide to pay that?
I really had no other choice for a small city this size that has no financial resources to be able to respond. The cost to the city was the $10,000 deductible. We had met the requirements for payments. We did our due diligence. We had tried to get the data restored unsuccessfully. We had tried every other option. You're talking about utility maps and GIS data, records for minutes and all the resolutions, ordinances, everything since the beginning of the city.
Right. A lot of important information. But was there a debate inside the city about what to do? Because first of all, there was no guarantee that the hackers would release your files after you paid them all that money. And then, of course, the bigger picture is you might have encouraged them to hack other cities.
That is true. However, it's not our money to spend. It's the taxpayers' money. You have to be extremely careful on what you do. And this was a last resort option. We were not going to be able to recover the data. We were told by the vendors that with this type of attack, nobody had ever successfully decoded this military-level encryption. Mm. And so we felt that the city would come to a screeching halt if we didn't, you know, recover this data. It would be a very expensive, very slow process to be able to recover the data. Any other option after we exhausted them.
You said military-level encryption. Do you know at all where this attack came from?
I don't know. We've left this in the hands of law enforcement to do the investigation. There's a lot of sophisticated people out there, and the cyber criminals seem to be able to increase their skill level constantly. So we have to going forward, we're looking at having enough protection and backup that we would be able to sustain an attack, or if we didn't, that we'd have a recovery within 48 hours or less.
So have you upgraded your systems, and how much did that cost?
The upgrade to the systems right now is approximately $330,000. We have iCloud storage, a backup solution for that, multifaceted authentication, and several other things. With all the upgrades that are being done, plus getting a high level of knowledge in the IT department within the city, that we will have a much better chance with the future.
Joe Helfenberger, city manager at Lake City, Florida, paid hackers a $460,000 ransom, most of that covered by insurance, to unlock the city's computer systems. Joe, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we're joined now by another city manager who dealt with the same problem, but made a different decision. Steve Schwabauer is city manager in Lodi, California. That's in California's Central Valley. Steve, welcome. You just heard that conversation from Lake City, Florida. Did it feel like you were looking in a mirror?
Yeah, quite a bit. We faced all those same decisions. All of our financial services data, money that people owed us for utilities, and money we owed our vendors for construction contracts and service contracts, everything was locked up in terms of our ability to try to figure out who owed us money and who we owed money to. We still had phone service for our direct lines, but any kind of an extension would not work.
Well, that's just a nightmare for a city. I mean, how do you even exist as a city trying to do the business of Lodi in conditions like that?
For our community, very tough. We're all reliant on technology to give us the economies to make it possible to serve in a very complicated world. And without it, it's very, very challenging.
So speaking of looking in the mirror here, the attackers demanded about $400,000 in Bitcoin. Sounds familiar. But you decided something very different, not to pay that ransom. Why?
Well, it really comes down to the simple fact that it was possible for us to reconstruct our data. We would have had a much harder decision to make if our backup data had been compromised, but our backup data was not. In addition, we had several third-party vendors who supplied our enterprise software who were able to set up offsite sites for us and allow us to operate from the cloud while we put together our on-site systems.
If not for that, would you have had to pay?
You know, I hate to answer that question. I don't know what we would have done, but we would have had a very hard decision to make. I assure you that.
Is it because you were prepared for this, that you were in that situation? Did you put protections in place so that your backup files, you know, wouldn't be accessed by hackers in this way?
Perfectly, no. Better than some, perhaps. But, you know, it's always a difficult decision with a municipality. You know, we have limited budgets. We're not like the state of the federal government that can pretend we have money we don't have. We're constitutionally required to have a balanced budget. So we can't just go spend $500,000 on a IT protection system without cutting it from somewhere else in our budget. Mm-hmm. And so most cities in this country are facing that same challenge. And they're having to decide, okay, now we realize how serious this threat is, and we've got to start having a more robust IT infrastructure to prevent this from happening. Even Lodi has gone about spending about $500,000 in buying additional resources to protect ourselves from a future attack. And even that is ultimately no guarantee.
Yeah. And do you think that the hackers knew that that was your vulnerability, that you don't have the budget that the state of California does?
I think that they know that about municipalities in general. I would be surprised if they knew the vulnerabilities of each particular city. As I understand the way they operate, they just send out a broad fishing net rather than a single fishing line, and they catch what they catch.
Let me just ask you a philosophical question. Why you think this is suddenly going on in so many cities like yours?
Well, I think we have a very sophisticated group of threat actors who see a crime of opportunity.
And you're the victim.
Us, Sony. We've seen a lot of large technological companies get hit. It's anybody who is reliant on their IT infrastructure is a potential victim here. Just, I think we're running through a cycle of municipalities right now.
Yeah. Could you blame a town like Lake City, Florida, that made the opposite decision and decided to pay the ransom?
Not standing in their own shoes, I think it would be really presumptuous of me to say that they made the wrong choice without knowing all the complications that they faced.
That's Steve Schwabauer, city manager in Lodi, California, whose systems were hacked and the city did not pay the ransom that was requested. Steve, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And by the way, we asked Steve if he knew where the attack on Lodi originated. He said their experts couldn't be sure, but they think it's likely the hackers were located outside of the United States.
Fifty years ago, one of the most influential American jazz groups of the 20th century found its voice in Paris. The group was the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and its surviving members are celebrating that anniversary with a tour, a new recording, a big retrospective box set, and a performance tomorrow night at their hometown Chicago Jazz Festival. Howard Mandel reports.
When the Art Ensemble of Chicago came on stage half a century ago, they looked like no other band of any genre, wearing face paint, robes, and mufti, facing east to Mecca for a moment before launching into music even more distinctive than their costumes. Saxophonist Roscoe Mitchell, who this year was named a National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Master, remembers when the band really gelled.
The Art Ensemble of Chicago became the Art Ensemble of Chicago when we left the United States for France in 1969. Before that, the Art Ensemble was a group that was being led by me.
The other members of the band were reeds and winds player Joseph Jarman, bassist Malachi Favors, and trumpeter Lester Bowie.
In order for the band to go to Europe, Lester had taken an ad out in the Chicago Defender saying musician sells out, when in fact he was selling all of his belongings to sponsor the band to go to Europe. This is when the Art Ensemble became the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
In Europe, the Chicagoans were received with an enthusiasm they hadn't found at home, where they were often tagged as avant-garde, a label Lester Bowie dismissed in a 1989 interview with WHYY's Fresh Air.
We never considered ourselves avant-garde. I mean, people considered us avant-garde. We've been trying to live that down now for the last 25 years. Because avant-garde has a sort of a negative connotation. When people think of avant-garde, it means something that they're going to have difficulty understanding, something that's going to be maybe chaotic. And avant-garde doesn't really mean that. It means just something that's a little bit ahead of its time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's atonal or it's a bunch of confusing sounds that may be difficult to decipher. So it's kind of hard to live that down, and that label was kind of stuck on us.
The Art Ensemble's music was a challenge to play, as drummer Don Moyet discovered when he joined Bowie, Favors, Jarman, and Mitchell in Paris.
As soon as I got there, they started kicking my ass every day. Every day rehearsals, you know, 8 hours. The work aesthetic, the group chemistry, different. And just the whole the concept of the creativity, the originality, honest approach of playing stuff right. They had such a high standard, you know. So I always felt like I was, you know, striving to get up to the level, you know. Lester had a vision. He said, look here, man, if you wanted to be part of history or not. Now, of course, I was, hell yeah.
The Art Ensemble's music combined high-energy improvisation and sophisticated composition. Roscoe Mitchell says he felt lucky to run into musicians who shared the same vision and were determined to carry it forward.
We always said that the Art Ensemble would remain the Art Ensemble if it even got down to one person, and that would be the Art Ensemble. We never thought of it in any other way.
Lester Bowie died in 1999, Malachi Favors in 2004, and Joseph Jarman earlier this year. But last autumn, Roscoe Mitchell and Don Moyer reconstituted the group with musicians drawn from generations inspired by the original band. The resulting album, We Are on the Edge, features a 15-piece Art Ensemble of Chicago orchestra. Far from a recapitulation of 50 years' repertoire, it's almost all new music. As Roscoe Mitchell says,
"Wow, where did the time go? I always think that there's much more work to do. I'm not summing up anything."
For NPR News, I'm Howard Mandel in Chicago.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.